Bobby through a hidden TV camera saw it all. How the children made his habits and new random dancing patterns, and I learned about all the nice guys. And you're full of this deception as your secret salad, but then when the bones are cool and die. This little birdie told me who was talking to a fly.
And this is Terrible Tommy, Tom Esker. This is Terrible Tommy, Tom Esker. Insurgent Radio Network calling. This is Insurgent Radio Network, and this is Terrible Tommy, Tom Esker, here in the heartland, in the bunker, right here in north central Indiana, transmitting to the world. Insurgent Radio Network calling. Insurgent Radio Network calling. This is the Insurgent Radio Network, and this is Terrible Tommy right here in the bunker, right here in the Robert J. Matthews Memorial Bunker, right here in north central Indiana. We're at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. That's where you send your donations for the show. And you should have had them in by now for this month, that's for sure. And you can send your snail mail to that box. And any questions you have on the internet, the website, well, communicate with merchandiseresist@yahoo.com. That's the webmaster. And the webmaster will take care of you. That's true. And our phone number, our big national intergalactical number, is 559-670-1473. And we change that about once a week. And we have another line. It's 641-715-3800. That's 3800. Then you put in 56890. Star, and Oh, maybe it's pound. And then you put your message in there. That's one's a freebie. We don't use it very much. And it's March the 24th, 2014, Moon's Day. Well, it's amazing to me that we're getting more and more rogue left-wingers and rogue right-wingers that are talking about the same. And so that's quite interesting. Now, on social issues, there's usually quite a bit of difference. But on a lot of more practical issues, on separations and secession and all that kind of stuff, and war, they pretty much go hand in hand, these two wings. For instance, we had this situation with the Crimea, which I say is perfectly fine, and Putin done it exactly the right way. But of course, your other people and the State Department and so forth are saying it's a horrible thing. Horrible thing. But they better be getting used to it, because there's more and more separatist causes around the world. Sort of anti-federal type movements. One of them's in Italy. Yeah, Venice. The Venetians have voted to break away from Italy. If I remember my history right, that was the starting point of a banking dynasty. Weren't the Borgias involved in that in Venice? But anyhow, they're pretty well on their way to separating from mainland Italy, because they, just like a lot of other places, are sick and tired of financing the people who don't seem to be able to do it. To the tune of, you know, a tremendous amount of money being soaked up by Italy from Venice. Same way with Louisiana in this state, in the States. They're only getting about $2 billion from the federal government, but they're sending them $5 or $6 billion. So they're a little unhappy with that, and they're talking secession. And up in Scotland, of course, Scotland's talking secession. They're real right in the middle of seceding. But also, another island out there that wants to secede from that secession. It's from Scotland, claiming that they're more like the old-time real Vikings. Well, let's listen to a little of this that I recorded early this morning. I'm not quite as chipper as I usually am, so I'm going to use some recordings today. Also, Chuck Schumer, the super Jew that votes badly every time. Now he's trying to rewrite the free press and screw up the free press.
Give you a couple of flashpoints. And they had a correspondent, one of their reporters there in Japan, doing a live report, and he let loose about something where Dr. Helen Cott had received death threats from some right-wing group there in Japan as she was touring, making the rounds, lecturing about nuclear safety and things like that.
Dr. Helen Caldicott, really? Death threats, huh?
Yes. Yeah, and it turns out that it was false. She put, she Twittered today and did release and clarified that that was not what occurred in Japan. That was just an error in translation, and that actually was death threats that she occurred in the 1980s here in the United States. So,
right. Well, that makes more sense.
Well, yeah. I always try to research things before I post. Sometimes things slip out of my, hands too, but this was just one that I found here, so I've seen it floating around with some of the nuclear posters that what was going on. So anyway, clarified a rumor up for you guys. So,
thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah, the thing that continues to be a problem there, and this is something that we discussed months ago, but a lot of outlets, including Democracy Now!, are discussing it again, so I thought I'd bring out a few salient points here.
Okay.
Because of the Yakuza's involvement in the hiring practices. It's just been recently admitted by the Japanese government that, oops, yeah, I guess we are working with our Japanese mafia and hiring people. Golly gee shucks, I guess that's true. Mm-hmm. So something that we discussed months ago is just now being admitted by the Japanese government. But what's compounding in the problem here, and they're releasing all these details about the people. I mean, they're destitute. They're homeless people. There are a lot of people that don't have any other way of finding work, and they're traveling hundreds of miles to import these people in. But because of the Yakuza's hiring practices and the fact that they desperately need people so bad, these people aren't being trained properly. Mm. So, but this was an incident.
Now, isn't this is very, very contrary to Japanese cultural traditions, isn't it?
Well, it is.
I mean, first of all, homeless people or people whose homes have been destroyed, families have been uprooted, communities have been decimated. It's not like here. I mean, we're a mobile society because it's a huge country. But Japan, I can only imagine that there is an abundance of mental problems going on right now because it's been such a disruption.
Yeah. I'm going to be watching a documentary here in the next couple of weeks about the misery index of how it's affecting the people there. But yeah, I could imagine that that's going on here. But what is compounding in the situation is that, you know, they're rushing these people in. They are not giving them proper training, if at all training, and they're ill-equipping them to handle the cleanup operations or the moving of these plastic pool hoses from tanks to tanks. So this report that you were reading last week, it must have been about a week and a half ago, mm-hmm. about the tanks that leaked, and it leaked out a bunch of contaminated water, that was thanks in part to the fact that they aren't training these people properly. And so these accidents will continue to happen. But speaking on the subject of the tanks, this is something I think I relayed to you about a couple of weeks ago, is that those tanks and the area, the landmass around Fukushima, the plant, that, you know, this is something, if you look at the Google Earth maps, and you can tell, if you look at the Google Earth maps of Fukushima, looking down at the plant, you can see the growing of these water contaminated water storage tanks that they're using to store all the water. Right. They're running out of room, man, and they can't build these things fast enough and get them shipped over. They're even using, like, tankers to do this stuff, but it's still not enough. So last week, TEPCO and the government announced that now they're just going to get the contaminated, treated water, but still contaminated, and just dump it straight into the Pacific Ocean.
Yeah, I read something about that, I think, on Natural News or some wire service. Why bother, right?
Yeah, it's like, sure, let's continue, you know, a bad practice here. So that's the next thing that, you know, and all of this continues to the point that, like, when is it going to stop, man? You know,
one of the horrors of all this is that it's TEPCO's fault or the nuclear industry's fault for building these monsters so close to or over areas that could destroy them. But this is not a Japanese problem. I mean, this is a global problem. And the part that I don't understand is why there isn't more cooperation among countries, especially in the Far East. I realize the Chinese and the Koreans and the Japanese all kind of hate each other. At least they hate the Japanese because of the war with China and the occupation of Korea. But that was then. This is now. And I don't get why there is not at least regional cooperation to try to contain what may be uncontainable. But it just seems like everybody's can say, well, it's a Japanese problem. I mean, that's such a capitalist attitude. Well, it's your problem, Corporation A. I'm Corporation B. And if you go bankrupt, I may get some of your customers. You know what I mean?
Something like that. It's greed. It's a matter of money. It's a matter of the fact that the radiation isn't drifting towards China and Korea, and it's actually going the other way across the ocean. They think that it's just dissolving or whatever. But then I read recent reports about the fact that that radiation stream that originated 3 years ago is finally making its way up to Canada on the west coast there.
Yeah, yeah. And hey, Sanchez, hold on a minute, okay?
Okay.
I got to do a break.
Fukushima,
okay.
And the pressures continue towards the startup of the remaining nuclear reactors that are still salvageable, and refueling them with and doing them the nuclear way, boiling water by a nuclear process. And you know about the state secrets, we've discussed that, but now they're beginning to crack down on even the students who are passing out leaflets and pamphlets. So, you know, that storm trooper mentality that we were discussing before is beginning to show its rear its ugly head. So, you know, there are people that are being arrested for even discussing it. They don't, on their media, I was reading recently, this is kind of old news, 2-3 weeks ago, but, yeah, they're not even allowing people to discuss nuclear issues because there's some sort of an election going on that's involving that. So they don't. They took it off. They want to yank the issue off the air, even though there's an election concerning it. It's sort of a, isn't that a double entendre? Or
where's the election?
There's an election of some sort of a nuclear regulatory some issue, and the tidbit, the information is not coming to my head right now, but it's something on their ballot. I think the election comes up in about a month or two, perhaps in June, but it's something on the ballot, and so as a result, they don't want the nuclear issue being discussed on the radio. So, you know, people are quitting over that. I think even somebody on NHK, I think, seemed to recall. But, yeah, so continuing.
Yeah, you know, the Japanese government, as you know, is now in the hands of right-wingers.
Of course.
Yeah.
Of course. It's very fascist now.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah, so anyway, speaking of fascists, I hope you don't mind me making a right turn here at Albuquerque and switching topics.
go ahead.
Church night garbage, right? This is the last one, and except I think I have one thing I want to share with you on hour three. It came as a letter from one of our listeners in, I think, in Minnesota. Melanie Hansen. I'll share that with you a little bit later. Anyway, Russell Crowe and the Pope. As you know, Russell Crowe is starring in the movie Noah. Well, apparently Noah is in a way kind of like the last temptation. Was it Christ or Jesus? Last temptation of Christ. That indicated that he had a relationship with Mary Magdalene. Was it Mary Magdalene? And so on and so on and so on and so forth. And he was married and, you know, which would make sense. You know, to be a rabbi, if he was a rabbi, and not be married would have been like, whoa, not good. However you say that in Aramaic. But anyway, so with the legend, or to the Christians and the Jews and the Muslims, the fact of Noah. And you know, the Christians so far, it's just them who are raising all kinds of hell about this. Which now leads me to want to go see the flick, right? Anyway, so Russell Crowe wanted to get a personal audience with Pope Francis so he could get an endorsement. Because Russell is a good Catholic, I don't know if he's a good Catholic or not, but it sure would pump up box office receipts, wouldn't it? If the Pope were to say, "Hamina, hamina, hamina, in the name of the Father and the Son and the box office, go see this movie." You know, it would have been great. But what he got today, apparently he met with the Pope today, all he got was a blessing. According to the Religious News Service, Russell Crowe used social media in recent weeks to try to cajole Francis to watch Noah, which has drawn fire from religious groups that say the film takes too many liberties with the biblical story of Noah's Ark and the Great Flood. Crowe had also asked for a private audience, if what they call it, private audience with Pope Francis. Anyway, the Vatican's chief spokesman, the Reverend Federico Lombardi, smashed both ideas. He said Francis would not watch the film, by God, and that Russell Crowe would not be granted a private audience. So there, neener, neener, neener. But Crow, who's the star of the show, along with the director, Darren Aronofsky, who, what do you want to bet, he's Jewish, and some studio officials, were in the invitation-only section of St. Peter's Square today, where they reportedly met the Pope briefly and received a blessing. Aronofsky was nominated for an Oscar 4 years ago for Black Swan, which was really a freaky movie. Said via social media, Pope Francis's comments on stewardship and our responsibility in the natural world are inspirational. Okay, yeah. When the opportunity to hear him speak arose, I couldn't miss the chance to listen and learn. Hmm. And Russell Crowe, who, if you follow this kind of stuff, is noted for his quick temper. You know, one would think that Russell Crowe would say, a string of profanities about the bleeping Pope wouldn't meet with me. What the bleep is wrong with the bleeping Pope? What the bleep have I ever done to the bleeping Pope? It's a bleeping movie! You know, something like that, right? But Crowe called his participation, Crowe's, in the audience, a privilege. Those are his words, a privilege. The film goes into wide release March 28th. So, now, some of the backers, financial backers of the movie, of course, are trying to turn that little brief encounter into a tacit endorsement by Pope Francis. Well, you know, what do these people want from Pope Francis? I mean, can you see the ermine and the drape and the robes and everything? Pretty soon they're going to have corporate logos on them. You know, MGM, whatever, Fox, Sam Adams. All right. Enough nonsense. Bruce in California sent me an email today, and it said, Mike, I ran across these very interesting articles that may or may not bear on the disappearance of Flight 370. Yeah, it's more speculation, but it's damn interesting. I was fascinated by the email from the Canadian captain you read yesterday. Yeah, that was about the fire in the on the aircraft, which is probably what happened, and it will never be discovered, depending on what part of the Indian Ocean it hit and sank into. But he sent me four links to four different stories that offer, and three of them were fascinating enough that, or a couple of them were fascinating enough that I thought I would share them with you. The first one is from the Express newspaper of the UK, not from one of these crazed right-wing websites based here in America where, you know, these trolls hang out and feed on each other. You know, it's not that. It's from the Express of the UK. Get this. Now, this is how this stuff can develop, okay? The headline, Malaysian plane, colon, 20 passengers on board that flight worked for electronic warfare and military radar firm. Oh, let me continue. A U.S. technology company which had 20 senior staff on board Flight 370 had just launched a new electronic warfare gadget for military radar systems in the days before the Boeing 777 went missing. Semiconductor, which makes powerful microchips for industries including defense, released the powerful new products to the American market on March 3rd. 5 days later, blah, 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 Flight 370. On board that flight were 239 people, including 20 who worked for a company called Freescale. Freescale. 12 of those 20 were from Malaysia. 8 were Chinese nationals. Freescale spokesman Mitch Hawes has said, quote, these were all people with a lot of experience and technical background, and they were very important people. It's definitely a loss for the company, end quote. Now, Freescale's shareholders, here's where you can really start to freak out on this. Freescale shareholders include the Carlyle Group of private equity investors whose past advisors have included George Bush Sr. and former British Prime Minister John Major. Okay? Carlisle's previous heavyweight clients include the Saudi Bin Laden Group, the construction firm owned by the family of Osama bin Laden, the fact that Freescale had so many highly qualified staff on board the Boeing 777 had already prompted wild conspiracy theories about what might have happened. The company says they were flying to China to improve its consumer products operation, but Freescale's fresh links to electronic warfare technology is likely to trigger more speculation and deepen the mystery.
Into that whole thing, I guess.
So now comes this speculation in the Express of the United Kingdom about Flight 370. And the fact that all of these passengers who worked for electronic warfare and military radar firms were on board. The Express says experts have been baffled how a large passenger jet seems to have flown undetected and possibly beaten military radar systems for up to 6 hours, avoiding radar via so-called cloaking technology. Has long been one of the objectives of the defense industry. And Freescale, the company involved here, has been active in developing chips for military radar. On its website, the company says its radio frequency products meet the requirements for applications in avionics, radar, communications, missile guidance, electronic warfare, and identification, friend or foe, end quote. And on March 3rd, the company announced it was releasing 11 of these new gadgets for use in, quote, high-frequency VHF and low-band UHF radar and radio communications, end quote. The company did not respond to questions from Express Online. This is the Express of the UK, same thing, including whether any of its missing employees had been working on the defense products. However, the company neither provided any responses to the latest bizarre conspiracy theory being widely published on the comment sections of newspaper websites and other internet forums. One comment reads, "Have you pieced together the puzzle of missing Flight 370 to Beijing, China? If not, here are your missing pieces. Patents, patents, patents. 4 days after the missing flight, a patent is approved by the patent office. Four of the five patent holders are Chinese employees of Freescale Semiconductor of Austin, Texas. Patent is divided up on 20% increments to five holders, and then it names the five, and they are all Chinese. If a patent holder dies and the remaining holders equally share the dividends of the deceased, if not disputed in a will. If four of the five dies, then the remaining one patent holder gets 100% of the wealth of the patent. The remaining five patent holder is, the remaining live patent holder is Freescale Semiconductor." The comment ends, "Here is your motive for the missing Beijing plane. As all five Chinese members of the patent were passengers on the missing plane. Patent holders can alter the proceeds legally by passing wealth to their heirs. However, they cannot do so until the patent is approved. So when the plane went missing, the patent had not been approved." End quote. Now, the Express of the UK then goes on to seemingly refute what it just published. The Express says, however, the absurd theory does not add up. Although a Freescale patent does exist under number U.S. blah, 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 none of the names listed actually appear on the passenger manifest released by the Malaysian authorities. Yada, yada. And my favorite story of all, Kathy found this a couple of days ago, and I said, oh, my God, I want to do it tonight. And the suggestion was I wait till church night. This is from Tennessee. But it was in the New York Daily News. A crazed Tennessee woman crashed her car into a church, lay on the altar, and then when her husband came to see what was wrong, she stabbed him in the chest because the devil told her that her husband was worshiping a NASCAR race. Stephanie Faye Hammond, 23. Admitted smoking weed all day. She told cops it was God's plan that she carried out in the rural Church Hill, a small town in the northeastern part of the state. The police chief there told the Times News newspaper, quote, she stated God had told her that smoking marijuana all day and all night was not good for her, and that she only needed to smoke it at night to help her relax. Mrs. Hamm further stated that she felt her husband, Stephen, was worshiping the NASCAR race at Bristol, Tennessee, which made her mad, and she began having thoughts that the devil put in her head, end quote, the police chief. Anyway, Ms. Hammond told police it was God's will when she rammed her Toyota Celica into the front doors of Providence Church, a building just across the street, by the way, from her apartment. Her husband, Stephen Hamm, came running after she called him for help. Help, Stephen! The police chief said, Mr. Hammond stated he found his wife lying in front of the altar, and as he checked on her, she stated, the devil is in me, and stabbed him on the right side of his chest with a large kitchen knife. Thwop! Mrs. Hammond stated, or Mr. Hammond stated he pulled the knife out of his chest and fled the scene. Well, I hope to shout. He went back to the apartment where he waited on police and EMS assistance. The husband was hospitalized and reportedly in fair condition the other night. Anyway, she was found about 30 minutes later in a nearby emergency room. Now, see, this is what's wrong with Christian education. She stabbed him in the right side of his chest. And the devil told her to stab him in the heart. It should have been more in the center, a little bit center left. But because she probably got a Christian education, she didn't wear the hell the heart. Schmart. Block. Anywhere. Stabbed him in the wrong side. She told police, according to the newspaper, quote, I was riding with them to a party at the racetrack when they brought me here. I was outside digging in the mud when the devil told me I need to go there. I knew God would help me live right. I start seeing things that others don't. Isn't God good? He told me that this would happen. And just look, I am okay. Notice how the real deep fundamental Christianity and insanity are just, I mean, they're Siamese twins. Fundamental any religion and insanity are just conjoined. Did I say Siamese? I'm sorry. Conjoined twins. You can't pry them apart. There's a little more to this story that you may find interesting, and I'll give it to you when we come back.
You mean the War of Northern Aggression, right?
Oh, no. This was the plot for Northern Secession in 1803. You see, Pickering was no scotch-running, mistress-groping, carriage-driving into the Chappaquiddick River Yankee from Boston like the Kennedys. No, sirree, Bob. Pickering was Secretary of State to George Washington and our buddy John Adams, and then a senator. And he was also a sovereign states' rights guy, maybe the most sovereign states' rights guy in all of New England. Well, by December of 1803, Pickering has had it with the southern states, the southern men, and with what he thinks is a southern scheme to purchase more lands west of the Mississippi River, fight more Indians in the process, and then ask the northern states to finance the whole shebang. Pickering begins assembling a secret group of northern men together who will work to rally support for the northern states to
secede. Dear Judge Peters, although the end result of all our revolutionary labors and expectations is disappointment, and our fond hopes of Republican happiness are wasting away in vain, the real patriots of 76 are overwhelmed by Southern pretenders to that character. I will not yet despair.
Picture this, projected on an 8-inch in-dash HD display. Timeline.
Christmas Eve, 1803. New York, New York.
I will instead look forward to a new confederacy, exempt from the corrupt and corrupting influence and oppression of the aristocratic Democrats of the South. There may be, no, scratch that. There will be a separation, and our children will see it in all its perfect splendor, the Northern Confederacy.
In the USA Today, just to piggyback on the discussion last hour of Italy and their secession, Crimea and their secession, and the other news that we were discussing. Now, the Greenwald story and Senator Schumer's promise to pursue this, what I believe is an attempt to make speech less free and to make reporting and journalism a more dangerous, and when I say dangerous, I mean you'll face jail time if you don't do what the state tells you to do, occupation. So I read the story about Senator Schumer and company about how we think there need to be new protections for journalists. We're going to write them. Let judges interpret them and see who it is that's really a journalist and who's not, what have you. I think that that goes hand in hand with the secession talk and with Crimea and Venetia or Venice and Scotland. And now we have this from Gulberwick, Scotland, USA Today Squared, today. In the late winter dusk, hundreds of Vikings are marching down to the beach bearing flaming torches. Their studded leather breastplates glint in the firelight as they roar and sing. It's a scene that would have struck terror into the hearts of the Dark Age Britons, and also perhaps an unsettling one for modern politicians on both sides of Scotland's independence debate. The fearsome-looking participants in a Viking fire festival known as Uphelia live in Scotland's remote Shetland Islands, a wind-whipped northern archipelago where many claim descent from Scandinavian raiders. They are cool to the idea of Scotland leaving Britain to form an independent nation and determined that their rugged islands, closer to Norway than to Edinburgh, will retain their autonomy, whatever the outcome of September's referendum. Shetland is different. We have Viking blood in our veins. Send the procession's magnificently bearded chief Viking, Jarl, by day a local authority housing officer named Keith Loban. There are only 23,000 Shetlanders, too few to make too much difference in the outcome of the independence vote, but they have Viking science confident in a big bargaining chip. A chunk of Britain's oil and gas reserves lie beneath Shetland's waters. Shetlanders are seeking new powers and official recognition of their special status, possibly along the lines of the Faroe Islands, a self-governing dependency of Denmark. The islanders feel their moment may have come as Scotland's fluid constitutional status gives them opportunities to seek concessions from both sides. Tavish Scott, Shetland's representative in the Scottish Parliament, said an independent Scotland doesn't have an economy if oil and gas doesn't happen. And that gives Shetland some leverage. A yes vote for independence on September 18th would trigger complex negotiations between Edinburgh in London over Scotland's share of Britain's offshore oil and gas out of a £1 trillion national debt. See, they're only arguing over £1 trillion. You ought to try 17 and a half trillions, buddy. A no vote is likely to lead to talks amongst about Scotland giving more power of its economy and resources, especially, or gaining more power, especially in energy reserves. Authorities in Shetland, which enjoys many local government powers, such as raising taxes and running schools, see the referendum as a chance to drive a hard bargain, something at which they have considerable experience. For centuries, Shetland was a poor place, ignored by governments far to the south and reliant on the unpredictable fishery industry and on making knitwear from sturdy local sheep. I've actually had some of their knitwear. I have a tartan cap. I had to specifically, when I was shopping in Scotland when I was there last summer, I had to specifically, I had to keep turning the camps over and looking for the tags, because they don't have a rule like we have that says that something was made in China. Now, they want you to know when it's made in Scotland. And so I had to go from store to store until I found an authentic, made in Scotland from Scottish wool, tartan, derby cat. And I did find one. Amid the rush of discovery, Shetlands negotiated a generous compensation agreement, blah, 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 blah. So basically here, what you have is a smaller subset of Scots who may or may not be Scots, desiring to do the same thing that the Venetians and Crimeans just did, which is to say, you know what, we don't have to answer to you big bullies. We can have our own government if we want. We can have our own little independence. We can have our own little republic here if we'd like. And we don't need permission from you. You know what's startling about this? I think what's startling about this, here we are 3,000 years into Western civilization, and it still is not a settled question among among ourselves, it seems, whether or not people are free enough and are accorded with the freedom to have and to possess, in all instances, the right of self-determination. Why is that still an open-ended question? Now, I would think that after all these years, and after all these centuries and millennia, and some of this amounts to dangerous malarkey, I would think that the right of self-determination would be a canon, a piece of well-guarded and well-documented Western civilization history. Of course you have the right to self-determine. Why wouldn't you? In any event, the question is now being asked again, and people, and this may just be a condition of poor education and of nationalist tendencies which have run so strong for the past two centuries. So, as I said last hour, I think that the arc of history is turning again toward decentralization and towards breaking up that which has been consolidated. We'll see. 866-95 has to be asked is, can you do it? And I think that should be settled in the affirmative. Of course you can. Let's see. This is Jason in Texas at 866-957-2874. Jason?
Well, sorry, Mike. I aim to disappoint sometimes. But driving through the country, trying to warm the globe up as much as I can in my 18-wheeler here, I noticed a lot of signs saying, do not enter federal property, federal this, federal that, U.S. government this. Supposedly, it's about 32% of the country is actual federal land. When you try to see, say, Texas or Louisiana, and the federal government owns a big chunk of land, how do you get out from underneath that?
Well, how did they come into possession of it?
They took it.
Well, if they took it, well, then take it back.
Well, they got a bigger arm. I'm just raising a question. I mean, how does a state get out?
I'm answering the question. If they took it, take it back. Let's just take, for example, the Louisiana Purchase. Just for one example. So, John Jay and James Monroe are over in France. Napoleon needs money. Jefferson has authorized Monroe to make some kind of a deal to get to wrest control of the navigation of the Mississippi River from the French. That's what they were basically sent there to do, to see to it that U.S. commerce and U.S. commerce ships could sail freely up and down the Mississippi River without fear of being armadaed or pursued by a French armada. Of course, they wouldn't have had the ability to do that because they were fighting a war at that time, but in any event, that's what they were sent there to do. Lo and behold, Napoleon's negotiator says, hey, how'd you like to buy the whole thing? We don't need it. Too far away for us. Napoleon doesn't want to go over there and rule, so why don't you make us an offer on the whole thing? And, of course, they did, and as they say, the rest of the story is history. But it's really not, because It's not an epic in history that is very well known, and what is known about it is usually incorrect. So when Jefferson is asked the question, Thomas Jefferson is asked the question, President Jefferson at that time, about whether or not Louisianans, or those that live in the Orleans Territory, where I currently am broadcasting this show from, in the New Orleans area, of who they belong to, well, Jefferson said, and who did the land belong to? Jefferson said that the land belonged to the people that lived on it. And that it was their land, that all the United States did was declare it a territory of the of the United States. They didn't claim to they didn't claim absolute dominion and ownership over the land. If a group of people were to get together and to claim that under this parallel line longitude of latitude and along the borders of this particular river, Heading east to this particular river along another parallel latitudinal line, that was going to become the state of Louisiana, for example, which did happen in 1807. And then we applied for admission into the Union. A constitution was drafted. It was ratified in January of 1812. Notice was sent to then President Madison. President Madison immediately acknowledged it and asked Congress, hey, you guys need to go ahead and sign off on this and send it back to them, and they did. And on April the 11th, 1812, Louisiana became a state in the Union. Now, if you read Louisiana's the Constitution of Louisiana and what it stated that the people of Louisiana owned the land, and it gave the dimensions for the geographical dimensions for the border. And say anything about Jefferson or Madison or the federal government owning the land, there's not even a mention of it in there. And this is the way that it was all the way up until that Lee surrendered at Appomattox and the subjugation of the South happened, and then Union generals were sent to basically be field marshals or impose a form of martial law on Southerners, and then they claimed buildings that they wanted to occupy and forts that they wanted to build, and that's when they started claiming some of the land. But it wasn't in the original. So the only way, in my view, that the feds can, that they actually own land in the manner in which you're talking about is, number one, perhaps they bought it. You know, they do buy land. If they bought it from someone, then if they, let's say they bought it from the state of Texas and they said, hey, we want to put a facility here, well, then that's different. You would treat that like any other property owner after you seceded and went your way. You would say, well, you don't, you know, you still have your land. We're not going to, you still have your title and your deed and all that. Now, we would prefer that you not conduct military activities because we're a sovereign state. We want you to move your army out, but you can have the land. And you can do whatever you want. We'll put a shopping center there. You want to auction it off? It's your property. We acknowledge it's your property. So that's a political question. That's not a question about, to me, anyway, that's not a question about how you have to defend that and go to war with the feds to get the land.
That would be great if so Fort Sumter was the first loss in the battle between the states and the federal government. And then, so for the second one, it would be, what, the Department of Agriculture building across from Kmart? Lest we forget.
The DOA building immediately across from a Walmart in downtown Plano, Texas was the site. Federal shelling began.
Well, you think with all these states screaming out, you know, hey, we can't drill here because it's federal land and this and that, you think the states would say, no, really, that's our land. We're drilling if we want to. It's kind of confusing to me how the states are actually kind of bowing down to the federal government. I don't understand why. If it's their land,
well, they have
the state's land.
Well, they've bowed down to the to the feds and many other things. I mean, I don't think that I'm breaking any news here when the tyranny of the national legislature and all of its attendant arms, all the tentacles that are attached to it, when it tentacles out and creeps out across the amber waves of fuel and decides that, hey, that's mine. We're claiming that. That's ours. That's not surprising. Do you have a specific instance? Because I'd have to actually hear of a specific instance where they are claiming that they own something and they own it by virtue of the fact that they took it.
Well, just some words of this is federal land, they're drilling on federal land, federal state, you know, federal parks and services, you know, it's like...
Well, that's another thing. The National Parks Act in the early part of the 20th century began the confiscation of, and some of the states participated in, saying that, okay, well, some of this land is yours. And now there were other lands that were part of, like, for example, I haven't read the annexation of Texas. What does the annexation of Texas document say? Does it say that Texas owns that land and is petitioning to join the federal government, the Union of States? Or does it say that in its act of joining the Union of States, that it cedes to the United States the remaining unsettled territories, and does it deliver a boundary? Otherwise, how did they come to claim that they own something? Did they come in by an act of Congress and say, hey, this is now a national park because we've declared that it is? And why would they do such a thing? Well, so that 20 years into the future, when somebody discovers oil on it, they can go, aha, well, yeah, you can drill on it, but you got to pay us. So you're asking a very abstract question without providing details. So and it's difficult to answer without knowing the specifics. Now, perhaps someone is listening that can offer up an actual specific. But in the absence of that, I mean, we're grasping at straws here, brother. 866-94. For a governor to say or to do what you are talking about, then it takes three branches, as you can see with what has happened in the state of Arizona, for example. And even then, what if a federal judge says, hey, we heard your little petition, we know your governor signed it, and we know your judiciary is behind it, too bad. We are of the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals, and we're going to tell you how it's going to be. It's like in the George Harrison Taxman song, let me tell you how it will be. And they're going to decree, like, we don't care what you did. Too bad. That's not the way the game is played, sir. So then what happens next? Does the state then say, okay, fine, go ahead and try and enforce it? And if they try and, well, we're going to withhold your highway money and this and that and the other. What then is the reaction to that? What is the how do you combat that? How should you respond? What is the response for that? Most people would say, you know, the states are a bunch of sissies. They're run by a bunch of sissies. Most legislators are arrogant and are so sure of them, are so sure of the current regime and its longevity that they have chosen. They have chosen the longevity of the regime over the independence and freedom of their people. And so that's why they vote the way they do, and that's why they won't do anything about it. In other words, they've chosen nationalism over federalism. I've met personally with my own representative, and I can tell you, he can talk a good game about being a little R Republican or a federalist. He's not. He's a nationalist. He can't see beyond the end of his own hand when it comes to what his state ought to do as a response to, as he told me, Mike, look around you. Everywhere I look, I see government. Well, do something about it then. And then I'm told that, well, our caucus won't do that. And the caucus, well, you know what? It takes a voice. It takes one, as Sam Adams said, one brush fire. You light one brush fire at a time. So the fact of the matter is, Chris, is that we have a bunch of states that are mortified. They are terrified of standing up to Mordor because, number one, we're all talking about money. This is all about money. This is all about, no matter how much the states love to complain and legislatures love to complain, they spend that federal money. They obey federal edicts because it funnels money to them so that they can pretend as though they appropriated it themselves. So as long as the printing press is cranking in the Treasury Department in Washington, D.C., as long as the Federal Reserve is telling those people that, yeah, you can just keep, you don't worry, you just keep printing, just keep doing what you're doing. As long as that is occurring, and as long as the feds can borrow money on the behalf of the states, which is what is actually occurring, don't expect any of this to change. As a matter of fact, I'm glad you asked this question. So what is the $17.6 trillion debt, if we break it down? What exactly is the $600 billion deficit this year and the total of $3.8 trillion in federal spending that's going to happen? What is it?
Well, read the bills. Yeah, a big part of it is the roads they're paving, the highways they're paving in my state, some of the local government buildings that they're building. I get that. But I had this conversation with coworkers one day about the feds are just a bank, if you will, for the states, and it's a hard concept for them to understand. And I think I think secession is a hard concept for people to understand, just simply because they don't understand the history of our country. But to them, it's been cast as a word. It invokes fear in people's minds, and they just
scary.
Don't.
Scary.
Yeah,
horrible,
exactly.
Horrifying. Well, and what I was going to say about, okay, well, what is that $3.9 trillion? That is spending that is occurring, and that is borrowing that is occurring that cannot be done in your state of North Carolina. Your state legislature is not going to borrow that kind of money. But they still have politicians that want to spend that kind of money. And they have central economic and central social planners that need to spend that kind of money in order for their dreams and our nightmares to come true. So what do? They've made a Faustian agreement with an external agent called the federal government. You guys be the bad guys. You guys borrow all the money and then send it back, some of it back to us, and let us spend it. And that's exactly what happened. That's what I call the dirty little secret of the 50 states and how this corrupt crime family union of ours works. And that's the deal. And if you're a state legislator and you're listening to this program, every time you appropriate a nickel, knowing that it came from a federal budget or from a CDGB, a federal block grant, or whatever the case may be, you are participating in the grift. You may think you have your constituents buffaloed and you're some kind of a crown prince of frugality and virtue, but you don't have all of us buffaloed. And you don't have all of us on board with the scam. And it is a scam. So that's how the game is being played, Chris.
Well, and I understand that. You explained it very well, but if you want to call them average Joe that I speak with, they have... Mm-hmm. They have no clue as to how the game is actually played, and it's kind of disheartening.
Well, just explain it to them, and just keep explaining it to them, and maybe someday a light bulb will go off, and they'll go, "Hey, I get it."
Well, thank you, sir. I need to.
Hi, how you doing this morning, buddy? I was just thinking about this thing. There's another word, you know, besides that evil word, secession. You know, that states need to bring back into their state houses and senate, and I will be speaking to my representative about it before long. He's in Atlanta, that god awful place right now. But I'll tell you what, man, this word exile, it needs to be brought back into the fold of the words used in our quest for freedom. And when these federal judges open their mouths in the states where they got no business opening their mouths, them and their whole family needs to be exiled out of that state. Run out. Just run them out. Tell them if you come back in here again, you will not come back under your own power. I mean, if that's the only way we're going to do this, I mean, you got to have, when you have secession, you have absolutely got to separate yourself from this deceptive endeavor. And I'm just, you know, besides myself, when I read the history of the state of Georgia, and you find that one of the governors a long time ago, I forget what time it was or what date it was, but he threatened a bunch of the federal people in the state of Georgia with exile. He'd run them out. I forget what the name of that governor was, but it escapes me. But I read a lot of the history of the state of Georgia, which has a very colorful history, mind you. It's like
Well, read the history of the Supreme Court case, Chisholm versus Georgia, and you'll find the answer that you seek. Chisholm. Well, now, I don't believe, was Chisholm the governor? No. Chisholm would have been the, who was Chisholm? Somebody sent me the case. I actually have it as a PDF and the proceedings of it. And what happened was, is that Congress had decided, they passed a bill deciding that they were going to tell Georgia how to deal with and how some of, I know what it was. Some guy claimed that he had a stake to some of the lands that were in the western part of Georgia, in the beginnings of the Appalachian Mountains there. And I can't remember what the exact circumstances were, but the state of Georgia said, like hell you do, it's not your land, that belongs to the sovereign state of Georgia, and we're going to land grant it out. And the guy said, no, it's my land. So he took his case to a federal court, and the federal court said, yeah, well, let's see if we can exert a little authority here. Yeah, this is that's his land. And then the state of Georgia said, passed an act and said that if any federal agent or federal marshal tries to come in to the state of Georgia and enforce that act, that they could be arrested and, if found guilty, could be hanged.
That's so,
but that's back in the 1790s. That's back when men were men and women weren't. So that's a long time ago.
Hell, Mike, that was a guy from South Carolina, wasn't it, that said he owned some of that property there?
I think it was. I believe the landowner's name was Chisholm, I believe was his name.
Right, and he was trying to get reparations for property in property for the Civil War. Is that what it was?
In the 1790s. As I said, I have the, should probably just get the case out and read it one day and write something about it. But you're pursuing the same end regardless of the circumstances, and that is the state of Georgia exerted its authority and said, we've considered what you said, Mr. Federal Judge. I think it was Samuel Chase, actually. How about no? 866-95-PATRIOT.
Well, that's about it for today, boys and girls. I had some better clips, but I forgot. Once I transfer a clip to this record pad sound recorder, and then I'm doing the show on it, I can't turn it off and take those out and put them back on. Anyhow, it's a mess. So anyhow, I've got them, and so I'll play them later. But it's quite interesting how this secessionist movement is beginning to gain ground all over the world. It's going to be quite interesting as time goes on. And whether right or wrong, we got nothing to lose as far as I'm concerned. I don't see anything to lose by moving in that direction, because the way it is now, it can never get any better. Back with you tomorrow, Tuesday. And 14-5. How about William Pelley Day today? William S. Pelley and his silver shirts.
You were the first thing that I thought of when I thought I drank you off my mind. When I get lost in the liquor, you're the only one I find. I did the things I ought to, still would not be mine. So I keep a tight grip on the bottle, getting loose and killing time. This killing away. There's an end. only price I'll pay. I'll be a happy man when I go, and I can't wait another day. This killing time is killing me. Drinking myself blind, thinking I won't see that if I cross